before you several sheets of paper titled something like The Ebb and Flow of Lectio Continual Bible Reading in the English-Speaking Reformed Churches, 1539 to the year 2000, and its recovery today. Back a number of years ago when I was studying in England, I happened one Sunday night to attend the St. Mary's Redcliffe Church that was across the Bristol Downs on a Sunday night. That was an Anglican church that had been built before Columbus sailed, and they were using the 1662 prayer book. They'd been using it there since 1662, and it was a very, of course, typical Anglican service. And during the service, they came to the portion where the Old Testament was to be read, and they had a reader who went to the lectionary and began to read from the prophet Isaiah. He read very slowly, deliberately, with an English accent that was beautiful. And I found myself being very moved by the impact of the scriptures read well. And as I pondered that experience, I realized that over the years, I could not recall ever hearing the Bible read in church apart from the text that was being preached upon, and typically that was one or two verses. Now, I'd been brought up in a Baptist church, attended a Bible church in college, a congregational church, and been in Presbyterian churches. Felt like I'd been around the block a few times in terms of exposure to what was there, in, at least in Southern California. And yet in those years, 22 plus years of being in church every Sunday, I could not recall just a Bible reading in church. And yet here I was being very moved by the impact of the scriptures well read. Before Dr. Boyce died, every time I heard him speak, he started, no matter what he was speaking on, he started with a little gripe session about the state of worship in the church today. Any of you here were there for any of those? Every time he talked, he got up and he began to talk about how abysmal the practice of worship was. And he'd go through element by element. And he'd talk about the preaching. You know, expository preaching has gone by the wayside. He'd talk about what we were singing, classical hymnody, psalmody, gone by the wayside. He talked about the absence of prayer. He didn't necessarily talk about scripture-based prayer, but again, prayer was deficient in our day. And Bible reading. The absence of Bible reading was another one of the issues that he pointed to as being one of the defects, one of the indications of the degeneration of worship in our day. But the way I see it is that Bible reading is something like the Rodney Dangerfield of biblical elements. I mean, it's there, you know, it's there in the confession. It's listed as one of the elements as distinct from preaching, the reading of the scripture. The directory separates it as a legitimate element. But whereas we fight over all of the others, right? We fight over what we're going to sing. We fight over how we ought to preach. We fight over whether or not we're going to pray and how much prayer, and we criticize each other on that ground. There's plenty of tussling over the sacraments, but we don't fight over whether or not the scripture ought to be read, I don't think. I don't think we hardly even discuss it. I don't think it's an issue. I don't think anybody's going to say, you know, you really shouldn't read scripture in worship. You know, that argument just is not out there being made. But I would at least anecdotally maintain that the reading of the scripture may be the candidate for the single most neglected element of them all. It's just one of those things that it flies by insofar as it flies at all under the radar screen. We're not giving attention to it. It has been neglected, I would say, for a long, long time in our circles. And yet, we actually have a command on this one. This is one of the elements where, I mean, John Frame could claim, in as he does in one of his books, that, or one of his articles, rather, that there is no explicit command to preach. I see Dr. Old's 7 volumes on preaching and reading of Scripture and the history of the Christian church as a massive rebuttal of that statement. But if he cannot find an explicit command for preaching, there really is one for Bible reading. Here's the Apostle Paul at 1 Timothy 4, verse 13. Until I come, give attention to the public reading of Scripture, to exhortation and teaching. And what the original text says is give attention to the reading. And I think in the context that public is rightly supplied, the reading, everybody would know what he was talking about. There's a context for that assertion. And they would understand in light of what was practiced in the synagogue that he's talking about the regular sequential reading of Scripture. And he's telling Timothy, don't neglect it. This is something that you must do. This is a part of the service of the church. This is what we do when we gather for worship. We read the Scripture. James F. White, the liturgist who was on the faculty of Notre Dame, refers to the decline of the public reading of Scripture as apostasy. He actually uses that word for what's going on in the churches today. He is that strongly convinced that what is going on is wrong and a terrible failure on the part of the church today. And yet, for Reformed Christians in our heritage, the Reformers were all but unanimous in their conviction that both the Scriptures should be read and that they should be read lectio continua, that the Scriptures should be read sequentially, that we should pick up the next week where we left off the previous week and work our way through books of the Bible. We, however, in our day, have dropped what surely was a major plank in the Reformers' program of what we might want to call church revitalization today. This was not a minor issue for them, particularly, ironically enough, with Cranmer and the Church of England. As Dr. Old points out in his 4th volume of his survey of the history of reading and preaching Scripture. One of the ways in which the Reformation was to be established in England was through both a lectio selecta, lectionary of the Sunday service, but he also outlined a program for the reading of the New Testament 3 times and the Old Testament once each year in the daily service in the church. And so in the vernacular, the Scriptures were to be read straight through every year in the context of the parish church. It was through the reading of the Scripture as well as its preaching that the Reformers sought to reform the church. So let's go somewhat into some of the historical and biblical background. I'll try not to get bogged down in too many of the details. But what the Reformers were reacting to was the medieval lectionary that had been codified by Gregory the Great, whose years were 540 to 604, which was a lectio selecta, or a selective reading. Not a consecutive reading, not a sequential reading, but a topically driven, calendar-driven selection of readings from the Scriptures. Some, in fact, as my Church of England friends would joke when I was at Trinity, some baffling in order to try to figure out why they were selected at all. But nevertheless, by some criteria, selected, but the criteria wasn't that of consecutive sequential reading of the Scripture. They reacted to that and looked back to what they believed to be the biblical and patristic practice, which was not a selected reading, but a consecutive reading, a sequential reading. They noted from the Old Testament, Exodus 24:7, that Moses was read in the context of the assembly of the people. They looked back to Nehemiah 8, 5 through 8, where Ezra read and then gave interpretation of the reading, and it was typical among the rabbis to see Ezra and that reading in Nehemiah 8 as the foundation for the establishment of the synagogue and the synagogue service. In the New Testament, you might want to flip around with me some so that we can see something of what was being practiced in the first century. Jesus in Luke 4, verse 16, it says that Jesus came to Nazareth, where he had been brought up, and as was his custom, he entered the synagogue and on the Sabbath and stood up to read. So it's the Sabbath day. It's the assembly in the synagogue. And what are they doing? They're reading Scripture. This was what was done. And the book of the prophet Isaiah was handed to him. So we are to imagine here a scroll being handed to him. The scroll is opened. What do they read? Well, they pick up where they left off. They would open the scroll. They would go to that point where they had read, up to where they had read the previous Sabbath in the prophet Isaiah. And he found the place where it was written, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, because he anointed me to preach the gospel to the poor," and so forth, as he reads from the prophet Isaiah. The point here is that Isaiah was read, and then when it was read, in verse 20, he closed the book and gave it back to the attendant. Their eyes were fixed upon him, verse 21, and he began to say to them, "Today," in other words, the exposition that would follow upon the reading of the scripture. Acts 13:15, the apostle Paul, on the Sabbath day in Pisidian Antioch, went into the synagogue and sat down, and after the reading of the law and the prophets. That's just just an observation of what was going on in the synagogue. What did they do? They read the law, they read the prophets. That was a standard part of the synagogue service. And then the synagogue officials say, "Brethren, if you have any word of exhortation for the people, say it." And Paul stood up and motioning with his hand, he said. So the scriptures were not just read, but then comments were made. Interpretation was given. Exhortation was made. Application was made on the basis of the scripture that was read. So there's this connection between Lectio Continua Bible reading and Lectio Continua exhortation or exposition on the basis of it. Two readings, reading of the law, reading of the prophets. Acts 15, verse 21. James at the Council of Jerusalem, making comment on the practices of the synagogues of his day, for Moses from ancient generations, arguing that the synagogue was established in ancient times. Moses from the ancient relative to the first century in which James lived. For Moses from ancient times has in every city those who preach him since he is read. In the synagogues, every Sabbath, he is read, and so he is preached. That is, there's this close connection between the reading and the preaching. And this is why the Reformers were so strongly in favor of Lectio Continua preaching. They saw that the two were governed by the same principle. You read consecutively, and then you preach on the basis of what's being read. So what is a sermon? A sermon is an exposition one of the read portions of Scripture. And even as you read consecutively through the Scripture, then you also preach your way consecutively. Lectio Continua, on the basis of one of the texts being read. Dr. Old and R.H. Fuller, another liturgical scholar, both argue that this was the principle upon which synagogue Bible readings were based. It was based upon the principle of Lectio Continua. You pick up the next week where you left off the previous week and read your way through the law, through the prophets, and then start over again. That's what's being referred to in 1 Timothy 4:13 when the Apostle Paul says, "Give attention to the reading." It's the church essentially adopted the form of worship of the synagogue and continued the practice of the reading. Then the Reformers looked as well at the patristic witness to this practice of Lectio Continua, reading of the Scripture, and then its exposition. They found examples of it in Origen, who lived about 185 to 254, the Sermons of Augustine, 354 to 430, Chrysostom, 347 to 407, Gregory of Nyssa, 330 to 395, Gregory the Great, 540 to 604. R.H. Fuller, in the New Westminster Dictionary of Liturgy and Worship, page 298, says, "For ordinary Sundays, the principle of Lectio Continua was used in the early church." That's a good line to read in the presence of your high church friends who are committed to a Lectio Selecta approach and believe strongly in its antiquity. Yes, it is ancient. It goes back to Gregory the Great. But before that, in the earliest centuries, from apostolic times until the period of late antiquity, that was not the method that was used. The The earlier method was that of Lectio Continua. So R.H. Fuller again, for ordinary Sundays, the principle of Lectio Continua was used, a book being selected apparently at local discretion and read in successive pericopes until it was finished. That's what the reformers found. And so that's what they began to advocate, both for biblical, historical reasons and for prudential reasons as well. And I've provided for you some of the statements from the early books of order and liturgical documents. So let's start with Martin Bucer's Strasbourg Liturgy. And you can read along with me as I read. This is dates from 1539, and it reads as follows. The minister goes to the pulpit and reads out of the Gospels as much as he proposes to expound in a single sermon, treating the book in succession. And they should be dealt with in their order, not as heretofore by picking out several pieces. You see the concern that the Bible must be understood in its context, and it's not understood in its context if your readings are based upon another criteria of selection other than that of successive readings. Otherwise, you're just pulling passages out of context and expecting them to be understood. Bucer is against that and wants the Bible to be read in its context. So picking out several pieces, often without particular skill, so that all other things given in the Gospels have been withheld from the congregation. In the afternoon and other hours, the other biblical books are also expounded. Like Calvin, Bucer argued for primarily the Gospels to be preached on the Sunday morning services and then the other books of the Bible in the afternoon, Sunday afternoon service, and then also in the weekday services. But you see the two concerns. One is that the Bible be read in context, and then that the Bible be read comprehensively, so that, as he says here, all the other things given in the Gospels not be withheld. If you're jumping around, taking bits and pieces, then you're omitting that which ought not to be omitted. And Lectio Continua forces you to deal with all of the Bible, to read it all and to expound it all. The Scots' first book of discipline from 1560, we see similar concerns. There we read, we think it most expedient that the scriptures be read in order, that is, that some one of the Old and New Testament be begun and orderly read to the end. He's not talking about reading Genesis to Revelation. He's saying you take a book and read it in order. Read from the beginning of the book to the end of the book. Then you pick another book. And the same we judge of preaching, for this skipping and divagation, means wandering about, from place to place of the scripture, be it in reading or be it in preaching, we judge not so profitable to edify the church as the continual following of one text. Why? Because you're going to understand it better, and two, because you're going to read all of it and not omit things that God intended for us to hear in the reading. The Middleburg Liturgy of the English Puritans from 1586, we read this, upon the days appointed for the preaching of the word, when a convenient number of the congregation are come together, that they may make fruit of their presence till the assembly be full, one appointed by the eldership shall read some chapters of the canonical books of Scripture, singing psalms between at his discretion, and this reading to be in order as the books and chapters follow, so that from time to time the Holy Scriptures may be read throughout. There's the concern that the whole Bible, the whole counsel of God be read. But upon special occasion, special chapters may be appointed. All right, the Westminster Directory, 1645, we read the following. Reading of the word in the congregation being part of the public worship of God and one means sanctified by him for the edifying of his people is to be performed by the pastors and teachers. By the way, there's a tension in this whole section here between the English Puritans and the practices that had developed in Scotland. And one of them was the Puritans did not want to have lay readers. And so that little barb there is aimed at the Scottish practice of lay readers. And the directory says, no, it's to be the pastors and teachers who are to read the scriptures. The next, all the canonical books of the Old and New Testament shall be publicly read in a vulgar tongue out of the best allowed translation, distinctly, that all may hear and understand. Third paragraph, how large a portion shall be read at once is left to the wisdom of the minister. But it is convenient that ordinarily one chapter of each testament be read at every meeting, and sometimes more, where the chapters be short, or the coherence of the matter requireth it. The next paragraph, the fourth, it is requisite that all the canonical books be read over in order, that the people may be better acquainted with the whole body of the Scriptures, and ordinarily, where the reading in either testament ended on one Lord's Day, it is to begin the next. Also, we could cite the daily readings in Cranmer's Book of Common Prayer, 1547 and 1662, and Baxter's Reformed Liturgy of 1661, each of which required a chapter of each testament in the Sunday service and then worked its way through the rest of the Bible in the daily services. So that in the English-speaking world in particular, there's a unanimous consensus in the Reformation era that the Bible is to be read, and it's to be read lectio continua. We're to read our way through the Bible. That was the standard on the continent. That was the standard amongst the Scots and the Puritans well into the 17th century. Then developments begin to appear, and the development that is the most interesting is that of the expository reading. It was actually first proposed by Bucer in his Grund und Ursach. German speakers, forgive me for that. But Grund is ground and Ursach is reason, and it dates to 1524. There is a very difficult to find English translation of it. But this was the first defense of the worship of Reformed Protestantism, the first attempt to explain why Reformed Protestants were doing what they were doing in their worship services, and to provide some explanation and some defense for the changes that were taking place in the medieval liturgy. And he proposes there that there be some comments that accompany the reading so that the people would better understand what was being read. As I mentioned, the tensions between the Scots and the English Puritans, the directory, in fact, addresses this in the fifth paragraph. I think I included that with your things. When the minister who readeth shall judge it necessary to expound any part of what is read, let it not be done until the whole chapter or psalm be ended. In other words, they're directing those who were reading and commenting, giving a running commentary on the chapter being read. They're giving them counsel here to hold your tongue until you read the whole chapter. Let the word speak for itself, is what the English were saying to the Scots. And then at the end, if you want to give some explanatory comments, hold your tongue until then. But further counsel, and regard is always to be had unto the time, that neither preaching nor other ordinances be straighteneth or rendered tedious, which rule is to be observed in all other public performances. That there again is the fear that these expository readings would squeeze out the sermon proper. The main thing I'm pointing out here is that the directory recognizes there's the distinction here between the reading with comment and the sermon. And what developed over time was amongst the Puritans in England, the Puritans in New England, and the Scots, was this expository reading of a whole chapter that would take something about somewhere around 30 minutes prior to the sermon proper, which would then typically be like what you find in all the Puritan works, you know, a sermon on one phrase from one verse and then the next sermon on the next phrase from the same verse. Lectio continua, rather, slowed to the snail's pace. Whole volumes on, you know, single verses. This sort of thing. We find the expository reading in English nonconformity, Dr. Old argues that Matthew Henry's Bible is in fact his Bible reading notes. Those are the notes that accompanied the scripture reading. Read that portion and then made comment upon it. There's evidence of it in Isaac Watts's services in Isaac Watts's meeting house in London as well. It's sometimes referred to as the double sermon, but the lecture, I'd like to call it the expository reading. There's evidence of it amongst the New England Puritan. The orders of service, for example, found in John Cotton's book, The New England Way, and his other book, The True Constitution, where he speaks of the exposition of a chapter of the scripture prior to the sermon proper. And then there's also evidence of it amongst the Scottish Presbyterians. Patrick Fairburn, writing in 1874 in his volume on pastoral theology, dates these expositions, expository readings, to the 1650s, the Commonwealth period, and really speaks of them as continuing to his day in the 1870s. And there's evidence of these readings in Thomas Boston's ministry. He died in 1732. Philip Ryken's work on Boston, in his work he speaks of that. And then amongst the remnant, that practice apparently survived survives even to the present. Willie Still was doing something like this in Aberdeen, though some have suggested he didn't know he was doing it, part of the Scottish tradition, when he did. But nevertheless, he'd stumbled upon this, which had been fairly typical of Scottish Presbyterian practice, that is, of having a lectio continua, expository reading of a chapter of the scripture that is part of the regular service over and above the sermon proper. All right, then decline sets in. It's not easy to establish why this decline took place. Somewhere between the middle of the 18th century and the middle of the 20th century, decline in the practice began to set in. By 1855, at least in the United States, Charles Baird, in his book Eutaxia, lamented this decline and called for a return to the directory's instructions that a chapter of each testament be read. Somewhere along the way, the expository reading was dropped. And when it was dropped, the regular reading fell out along with it. So that rather than merely going back to the practice of simply reading the scripture, reading fell out of the service altogether, apart from the text that was being preached. You can see evidence of this neglect in virtually all of the 19th century pastoral and preaching manuals, which will make no mention or give no instruction or exhortation with respect to Bible reading, other than merely the mechanics of reading scripture. You find evidence of the decline in that the 20th century pastoral and preaching manuals also, and books on worship have virtually no exhortation or instruction with respect to scripture reading. No one seems to be aware of this background or cares about this background practice of lectio continua Bible reading. It's been neglected in the journal articles. Lately, there has been some revived interest, I'm talking about the last decade, in Bible reading. There's quite a bit of interest in lectio continua preaching. There has been almost no interest that I can find anywhere, and I've done the internet searches and all that, and virtually no interest in lectio continua Bible reading to be found anywhere for several hundred years. And until Ligon Duncan wrote the article in the Boyce Festschrift on Bible reading, in which he urged a return to the directory's instructions on reading lectio continua through chapters of the Bible. That's the first article that I could find to advocate specifically lectio continua scripture reading as a regular part of the practice of the church. Let me give a couple of tentative explanations as to why there was this decline, a decline to be found a loss, rather, of the practice of Bible reading in Presbyterian, Congregational, Baptist, and Methodist churches. Why? Dr. Old suggests in the first case that it has to do with the scholastic preaching method that was characteristic of the English Puritans. His argument is that on the continent of Europe, you had this cadre of Renaissance scholars committed to the principle of ad fontes, of going back to the sources, who were proficient in the original languages, and so there developed this group of scholars who were committed to preaching their way sequentially through the scriptures. They went back to the form of the patristic homily, in other words, in their preaching, rather than the medieval scholastic analytical method of preaching. And he argues that there was no similar group of scholars in Great Britain, that the great preachers at the Reformation era in Great Britain still were clinging to the scholastic method, that the Puritans largely followed this and tried to combine, as they do in the Directory, the Lectio Continua principle with an analytical method that was more scholastic than biblical. And so, you know, the various divisions in Puritan sermons and their interpretation and doctrines and uses and so forth is very much reflects a scholastic approach to preaching. And he says in the long run, you just couldn't put the two together. The scholastic approach is a detailed analysis of short pericopes, short text, small text, and combining that with Lectio Continua of major portions just in the long run didn't work. And so preaching became more and more topical, less and less text-driven. Secondly, the commitment to the weekday Lectio Continua found both amongst the Anglicans and the Puritans. The Puritans were saying that really the Lectio Continua is what ought to be done in the home. It's in family worship that you read without comment, that the very purpose of the public assembly is so that you would have reading with comment. And that's why you have an ordained ministry. So in private, you read without comment because you're not, as heads of households, not really qualified to make comment. But when the public assembly takes place, the reading has comment by the minister. And so they moved away from the Lectio Continua method, both amongst the Anglicans and amongst the Puritans as a part of the Sunday services of the church. Third, time constraints. As sermons grew to be an hour and a half long, they tended to swallow up the readings. Cotton Mather, in fact, makes, in one of his works, comments on the variety of practices in Puritan New England in his day, and recognizes that John Cotton, his grandfather wanted there to be these Lectio Continua readings in the services. Increase Mather, his son, argued that they ought to be dropped altogether and that they only ought to preach and not have the Bible readings in the services. Cotton Mather said there was still a debate going on in New England, a variety of practices, and he was happy with that being determined on a local basis. Another possibility that Dr. Old raises has to do with the influence of pietism. He would argue that evangelical worship today has more to do with pietism than it has to do with the Reformation, and that the preference for selected devotional readings, that is, readings based upon the devotional quality of the passages to be read, really overtook the commitment to consecutive readings. In other words, what you read really needed to be inspiring. No sense plowing your way through 2 Samuel. You know, find the ones that really inspire the people, the most beloved passages, so that the needs of inspiration about which pietism was so concerned really squeezed out the disciplined, systematic approach to scripture reading. That plus the other needs of inspiration, the evangelistic sermon, the special music, the choirs, and so forth, time constraints further squeezed out the commitment to regular readings. So here we are. What I'm arguing is that we need to go back to, we need to restore this plank in the Reformers' program of church revitalization, that we have been wrong to move away from it, our negligence is culpable and that we need to restore it. And as far as a practical aside, after I'd been at Independent for about 15 years, I started counting up the number of books that I had preached through, and it was, I can't remember exactly at the time, it was probably about 25, somewhere between 25 and 30 books of the Bible, and I was patting myself on the back for my wonderful commitment to expository preaching and how much we'd been able to do. But the next thought was, you know, let's say it was 30. Well, there's 36 more books of the Bible to get to. 15 years, 30 books, 15 more years. In other words, it's going to be 15 years, maybe 20 years before I get to some of those books. That seemed to me to be a neglect of duty on my part, that our people would not have been exposed to great sections of Scripture in our services because I was not preaching at a pace adequate to get them there for another 15 years. I started to ponder that some, and I thought, you know, that we could get there a lot quicker if we would read and not just preach. And we'd always had an Old Testament reading, typically determined by the text for the morning sermon. And then we didn't have certain readings in the evening. And so about 5 years ago, I thought that it was a matter of duty on my part to quicken the pace by which at which our people would be exposed to the reading of the whole Bible. And so we began to read Sunday morning a text unrelated to the morning sermon, and then just in the last couple of years added a text in the evening service as well from the Testament not being preached. And as a result of that, we have already gotten up to around 60 books of the Bible. And I've provided at the back here just an example of 1 year. This is what we're reading through in 2006, what we're reading through in the morning service, and what we're reading through in the evening service. And in the morning, I've been preaching through Matthew, so it's mainly Old Testament texts in the morning. And in the evening, I'm preaching through a harmony of Samuel, Kings, and 1st and 2nd Chronicles. And so it's mainly New Testament, not exclusively, but mainly New Testament. In the evening, I scale down the reading for communion services and you know, Christmas services and that sort of thing, or let the calendar determine those readings. But you can see 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 different books of the Bible in the evening, 5 books of the Bible in the morning. You know, about 10 books a year can be covered, depending on which books you're reading. I think that's worth it. I think that that's important. And I've been extremely pleased at what my congregation has been exposed to just simply through reading texts of Scripture to which we would not have gotten. I'm not going to get to 2 Corinthians probably for a long, long time. But they're hearing it read right now. And I think it's a good thing. I think it's, as it was for me as a young theology student in England, it can be powerful just to hear the Bible read well. So here are my recommendations. I've sort of reworked the order a little bit, but let me briefly hit on these. Number one, I recommend that you read a chapter of each Testament in each service just as the directory of worship commends that we do so. I think you need to do this roughly, not slavishly. I think some chapters have to be broken up into two or even three pieces. I think that there are some sections of Scripture that are not well suited to public reading, and so you may need to skim over those lightly and make a short comment and then settle on the text that you will read. But I think that the basic guideline holds that you ought to aim at reading about a chapter in each Testament in each service. Secondly, read the Testament not being preached. I propose this as a way of maintaining biblical balance. As I just noted, I'm reading through Matthew in the morning, so I'm going to read from the Old Testament. I'm preaching from the Old Testament in the evening, I'm going to read from the New Testament. That way you're getting the balance of the Bible. Counsel of God is receiving exposure. Third, read passages that are accessible to the congregation. What I'm really pleading for here is wisdom in the implementation of the program of Lectio Continua. For example, I just think it'd be foolish to say, okay, announce one Sunday, all right, we're going to start. I've come back from Twin Lakes, I'm all jazzed up about this, and we're going to start reading through the Bible, we're starting Leviticus. Just think that would not be wise. I'm not saying it's not scripture, I'm not saying it's not important, I'm not saying there isn't a time when you might do that. I am saying that I think it would be very unwise to start there. I don't think it's very accessible. I think that it's better until your congregation is more mature in the scriptures. I think it's better, it's wiser to start with books of the Bible that are much more accessible, like the Gospels and Acts and the Psalms and the Epistles and Proverbs and some portions of Old Testament narrative. Consistent with this, then I would recommend that you skim over with descriptive comments exceptionally remote or difficult texts. For example, passages such as Exodus 25 through 31, which are describing the tabernacle and its furnishings. I think an expository series on that could probably prove to be extremely valuable. But I have some doubts about whether or not the reading of it would be. The sockets and the poles and you know, I think that's remote. If I were you, I would just skim over those, giving a brief description of what's there, and then settle in Exodus 32 and start reading there. I mean, all in the same service. You would just explain what's in 25 through 31 and then hit the next text. Joshua 15 through 21, which outlines the distribution of the promised land to the 12 tribes. I would skim over that. Maybe I'm not a purist. Maybe I'm giving away to pragmatic considerations. But I believe that they're not as accessible to the congregation. Chronicles 1 through 9's genealogies. I just skimmed over. Skim's a better word than skipped. Shows more reverence for the inspiration of all the scriptures. Nehemiah 3, describing the placement of the workers on the walls of Jerusalem. You know, so-and-so was here and so-and-so was there. So it's a little remote. I would skim over it. So I think they are ordinarily best handled with a summary comment while transitioning to the next text to be read. Fourth, vary scriptural types. I think it'd be unwise to plow straight through the minor prophets or the Old Testament narrative beginning from Genesis, plowing straight through to Nehemiah. Instead, I would recommend that you try to vary the diet, which is what I've tried to do in these two programs of reading that I've provided for you. Move from gospel to Old Testament narrative to epistle to Old Testament poetry to Acts to Old Testament wisdom and so on. Fifth, provide brief introductions to books and chapters. By brief, I would mean normally a few sentences lasting from 15 to 45 seconds. A few comments setting the stage for the text to be read, anticipating perhaps a difficulty in the text, but by doing so, I think you can do much to enhance the spiritual profitability of the reading if you give it just a brief setting and statement of concerns. Then sixth, read slowly and clearly and with nuance. I think it goes without saying, but I'll say it anyway, you can read the scripture more or less well. Right? You can read it poorly or you can read it well. Why not read it well? I think you can enhance the understanding of the congregation by studying the passage, at least at some level, so that you understand where the stress points are, what to underscore as you read by your tone of voice, by the emphasis you give to the text as you read it. That was what was so powerful about the reading at St. Mary's Redcliffe in Bristol. The person reading was a master of reading scripture. And so the meaning of the passage was illuminated by the excellence by which that individual read it slowly, distinctly, nuanced in such a way as to help the listeners to grasp the meaning of the text that was being read. So that's the basic encouragement that I would like to give you in the way of implementing scripture reading in your church. The goal at which we are aiming is that substantial portions of scripture be read in the assemblies of God's people, because that is what God has required of us. Going back to biblical times, that is what was practiced by the patristic and Reformation era churches, and above all, because that indeed is what will edify the people of God. Now, do you want to break, or do you want to take questions? All right, questions. Dr. Sproul.
Yes.
I don't know how to answer that. I've never timed it. But I guess if you look at these, the pericopes I've picked, I would think it would be about 3 minutes. Three to four. No, I'd say probably three. I don't think it's 5 minutes, but I think it's three. I think it's more like three. And I think it helps to recognize that a decision to do something in a service is at the same time always a decision not to do something else. You know, you have a finite amount of time. That's why I really believe that, at least in our culture, that an economy of language needs to be used in leading a service. You need to cut out all the extraneous chatter that goes on and lead the service, you know, very succinctly. Because often it's just time is just lost, just wasted with announcements and extraneous matters. And, you know, 3 minutes is not a lot of time, but it is at 12 o'clock when everyone's checking their watches. The problem is we lose the time at the beginning, and we can't get it back. And so is it important enough to fit it in? It may mean something else that's not as important needs to drop out. A decision to do one thing is a decision at the same time not to do it. Yes. My answer would be that if you are counting on the fact that people are literate and therefore can read their Bibles at home, and therefore they will, I have a high regard for the depravity of man. I just don't think that, I don't think the church can count on the majority of the congregation reading the scripture either privately or in families. I don't think it happens. So, and even if it were, I still probably would argue that it's an element of our worship that we read Old and New Testament in our services. Yes, the ministers. It's another subject, but I really believe in ministerial leadership in the worship service. I just think that's our job. That is what we were ordained to do. The church invested a lot in setting us apart, putting us under care of sessions, putting us under care of presbytery, sending us off to seminary, examining us, ordaining us, installing us. For what? To lead worship services. I mean, that's a major part of what we do. We were set apart for the sake of public ministry. Not everybody can do public ministry. A lot of people can do private ministry. But public ministry, you have to be really examined and qualified. And we are very tedious in our requirements for that. So I really think that's what we're supposed to do. So I pretty much hang on to that myself and the other ministers. Yes?
Consecutive strikes at the unity of the service. And here's what I mean. I usually preach through books of the Bible. And we did have Old and New Testament reading typically in the service. But they're selected because they're either alluded to in the sermon text or maybe quoted in the sermon text or in some other thing. And sometimes I'll draw them in and I've already read them, so I can refer to them. And he's quoting from this Old Testament passage we read earlier. How would you, if you could just speak to that question of unity of service and all the lines of things versus reading consecutively from the book of the Bible, may I know?
It's become a greater priority for me, and I'm arguing for the priority, that they get more exposure to more scripture. And so I'm willing to sacrifice the parallel passage from the Old Testament that accompanies the New Testament sermon for the sake of more exposure to more scripture. That's a value judgment. It's a priority judgment, but that's the one that I'm really making. Okay?
Another way of handling that same issue is to pick the passage that I go through, let you continue on your reading, but to allow that reading to actually inform the hymns that are chosen, so you do have a sense of continuity actually from even that reading, that there's something that's moving maybe even both in the morning and in the evening from what we're reading.
Yes. And is it the case that every element of the service has to thematically tie in? I mean, my opening hymn never ties in thematically. Well, not in never, but except for Christmas and Easter and Palm Sunday, when I think it's profitable to recognize that indeed is which Sunday it is. I never pick the opening hymn on the basis of a theme. It's just always a great hymn of praise. So I don't think I don't have to tie my prayer prior to the sermon into the sermon and anticipate the themes of the sermon. I mean, I've never thought to do that. I just don't think every element, it's nice to tie things in thematically. It's nice for the last hymn to tie into what you've just sung. I always try to do that. But I don't think most of us need to feel like we need to tie every element into it. Yes?
Are you using a responsive reading? Can you use a soft responsive reading in place of a solo person reading for all that?
Yeah, almost all those responsive readings are psalms, so you'd be limited. No, I guess in the Trinity hymnal there are New Testament ones, aren't there? Are there? I don't ever use responsive readings. I'm not crazy about them, but I think that's just a stylistic or personal preference. I just like better the idea of Scripture being read by the minister, authoritatively read. Yes?
I think one of the things that you bring the two of these together, and I haven't done this, and I wish that I would have, I'm preaching through Mark almost every time. I have to do what Terry said, but every week, there's something in some chapter of Isaiah that relates to what I'm preaching. Not because Mark quotes Isaiah like Matthew does, but just thematically, they're tied. You can broadly do it. Should I have started reading Isaiah sequentially when I started preaching Mark? Probably. Would have made a lot of sense. And broadly, there's some unity, but you're maintaining both.
Okay. R.C., do you want to ask another question?
Yeah, I'm sorry about the question. You made a comment about it. Why are you reading scriptures? Two of us read them well. And just as an observer, I would say all the church I've been to, we've heard all the preachers I've heard, I would say the single most glaring weakness that I've heard Sunday morning is really poor interpretation of the public preaching. And I think the main reason for that is that we've been trained in the basic principles of world interpretation. And it's not rocket science. And there, I don't know if you can suggest a book or something, but there are manuals to instruct people on when you emphasize nouns, verbs, things like that. That just a few principles will greatly enhance the world interpretation of the reader.
Do you have a book to recommend that does that? Right. Hear, hear. Ligon is saying it needs to be practiced. Yes?
I was just going to say, piggybacking on Troy, Dr. Troy said that in Mark 10 Hughes and Donald Carson.
We had a speech teacher at Trinity Bristol, and I thought he was going to cry. He was so upset with how horrible I was. I don't know if it was the American accent or just buffoonery on my part, but he was about ready to throw me out of the room. Other questions? Excuse me? What do I tell the people to do while I'm... Yes, I really do want them to open, especially if there are longer passages. I feel like most people will follow better if they do that. But I have to say I'm sort of a hypocrite because at times I like to just sit back and listen. You know what I mean? Yes.
Do you recommend certain versions of the Bible not be used to be read, although your church uses? But certain ones certainly don't lend themselves to long public readings. Is there certain ones you would...
Are there versions of the Bible that I would say don't translate? Yeah, I think you shouldn't use a paraphrase. I think you ought to use one that pretty strictly sticks to the text and is a translation of the text, not a short commentary, not a paraphrase. I think that for the sake of the integrity of the public service, I think that it should be a fairly strict translation. And in my context, where I have an old congregation on... holiday Sundays, I will usually go back to the King James Version just for the sake of the older people who I know want to hear the older language and for whom that is very meaningful. But otherwise, I just think a good solid translation should be used, but not a paraphrase.
Is there a line between what you call nuanced reading and then what I would call dramatic reading? How much dramatic you want to get?
I don't want it to become a skit, if that's what you mean. T. David Gordon talks about the argument of the beard. Is there a difference between drama and a dramatic reading and a reading with nuance? And aren't they on a continuum? And since they are, they're all the same. You know, if you're clean-shaven and the next guy's got a day of growth, and the next guy's got 5 days, and then you've got a full beard. Since they're on a continuum, is there really a difference between being clean-shaven and having a beard? There is a difference between a drama, dramatic production, and a nuanced, careful reading. And there is a line, and I can't tell you where it is, but there's a line there somewhere, and I know when you've crossed that line. It does. Sure, you interpret it when you read it. You do. You should. Yes.
Would you have any comment or examples of the missionary value of reading Scripture publicly, just in terms of on the foreign field or even in America, being biblically illiterate, which is much more the case in other countries, one. And two, simply putting Scripture in front of people to let them see it and provoke questions, as it were.
I'm not sure I understand. You're asking me about the value of public reading? Oh, I forget who, but there are Puritans or others who've testified to being converted through public reading. I think it has great value. I mean, just think about reading through the Sermon on the Mount. You're not preaching on it, but you're just reading through the Sermon on the Mount. When I was in college and was trying to witness to people, I would sit them down and read from the Sermon on the Mount and say, surely... you're just absolutely dumbfounded by the power of these words. I think it has great value myself.